So a few months ago, I recorded a podcast with Michael Pilarski on Keyline Plows, and it was in preparation for an upcoming event where Neil Bertrando would be there giving a Keyline Plow demonstration as well as giving some presentations on Keyline Plowing. And then, as luck should have it, not only did I see it, and I really enjoyed it, and there were some points in the presentation that I did not know, but as it turns out, Neil listened to the podcast. And then that's not all. Neil tracked me down and said he had some things to tell me. So I fired up the little recording contraption here, and it turns out that somehow Neil suckered Owen into listening to it too, and Owen also had some things to say. Have I missed anything? Have I left anything out?
Well, also, Paul, we are at a site where Sepp Holzer is transforming landscape, and we've done a little Keyline demonstration here, too.
Well, that's true. I saw that. And the name of the fellow that was driving the tractor?
David Roniger.
And that's from the fellow that Roniger seed potatoes, isn't it?
I think that's correct.
Yeah.
And he's living now in Montana in Hot Springs, I think, running a natural food store and doing a demonstration garden where people can come and learn about small acreage farming.
So I took some video of him, and he says, what are you going to do with that video? I said, I'm going to put it on YouTube. And he got all excited, like, you know, he's going to be a movie star. So now I've got to put that video up about Keyline Plow stuff just so that he'll be happy. So, all right. And then
maybe we'll get some work, too.
So I've got Neil Desert Rat Bertrando here.
And that was right on my name tag.
Yeah. Yeah, and so what you got a website?
Currently, I'm only running a Facebook profile. It's a group, RT Permaculture, which is also my business. And we have, as a consortium that I work with in Reno, Nevada, we have a website, Loping Coyote Farms, where we do a small-scale nursery, and we do presentations and educational seminars, and then we do design and consulting for people.
So, okay, if somebody wanted to hire you and give you too much money for what you do, and they hated Facebook, could they send you an email?
Yes, they could. It's Neil Bertrando, NeilBertrando @gmail.com.
You just made my podcast boring. Okay. And
encourage me to repeat that.
No. Once is enough. People can use the rewind button or something like that. Okay, and then we got Owen.
Hello.
And Owen, do you have a website?
I don't have a website, but you can find me at permacultureglobal.com. Type in my name, Owen, last name Hablutzel, Hablutzel, just like it sounds.
Would you like us to
Man,
do
no, 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 no.
And if you want to email me, it's Owen, go to Owen, Owen, @gmail.com.
Okay.
Could you spell that permaculture?
Yeah, no. All right. And you're with PRI USA, which is Jeff Lawton's outfit.
That's right. I'm one of the directors with PRI USA. I also do work with Holistic Management International. I'm a certified educator with them. So I combine these frameworks along with permaculture and, Keyline design, and having fun with that.
So have you done much Keyline stuff?
Yes.
Okay, and if I were to hold a ruler up to it, I would see it's how much?
How many acres or how many?
Sure.
Properties?
Well, I know Neil's done quite a lot, and he's gone given presentations. Owen's done more than you.
Definitely.
Oh, geez, so I'm going to catch hell from Owen more than Neil. All right, let's get on with this flogging. Okay, so you guys listen to my podcast. I thought it was a pretty good job, but you know, so but now look at all them notes. How many? So what do you have to say? Lead off, Neil.
Well, I think you did a great job too, Paul. You and Skeeter covered the bases. But I think I would approach it from a different starting point. You started with the plowing, which is really one of the techniques. And Keyline is a design system. It's a whole farm planning system, and it allows us to rapidly plan a whole landscape. And it's primarily for kind of a silvopastoral landscape. Yeoman's with raising cattle. And it's combining large water storages with pasture land with contour tree belts or a mixed forestry.
Okay. And so I would imagine that the reason why permaculturalists might talk just, you know, dominantly about the plowing is because, of course, in the world of permaculture, we kind of have everything but the plowing. And then, of course, Keyline is considered part of it. But whenever we talk about Keyline, we're dominantly talking about the plowing techniques in order to be able to deepen the soil and be able to hold water on the land a little bit longer, stuff like that. And from a broad acre perspective.
Right. Well, Keyline was developed before permaculture, and Bill Mollison studied up on the Keyline system and looked at what P.A. Yeomans had done, and it actually informed his interpretation of broad acre strategies for large portions of the landscape, dam locations, how to site trees and pastures and such.
Right. I think permaculture is actually a collection of a lot of different things, along with, like, you know, 10% extra frosting right from Bill.
I would agree with that. Maybe more than 10%, but definitely it's a collection of ideas from around the world that have been made into a system that becomes more robust as we add more stuff into it.
Within that, Keyline, I think, has been maybe the most influential of sort of anything that's got that permaculture originated from. That's my opinion.
Okay. So, all right. So I think that's a good point. And we left that out of that that previous podcast, that part?
I didn't hear anything.
Okay. All right. All right.
General influence on the permaculture concept.
Good point. All right. What do you got, Owen?
Well, I mean, I agree with Neil. I mean, that's really the main point about this, or one of the most revolutionary things about Keyline design, is it really is the first planning system that takes a holistic approach to doing a whole farm or a whole property at once, and very consciously so. Like Yeomans would say, every decision should be made with the whole in mind. So he very consciously had this aim with his system. So that's number one, because as we've seen in conventional agriculture, a focus on parts or focus on, you know, single yields and focus on, you know, monocultures misses the whole holistic point, and you end up paying for it in the end in a multitude of ways. A second thing about Keyline design would be coming back to the topsoil development, the rapid topsoil development, which you guys did cover quite well. But that, to me, is probably the second most revolutionary thing, so rightly so did you cover it. Prior to Yeomans, the teaching, and still to this day in universities, the teaching is that it takes 1,000 years to create an inch of topsoil. You know, of course, they're talking about natural processes, and to a degree that's true. But that thinking has gone over into agriculture and into human interaction to assume that that's as fast as we can also replenish or create soil, and Yeomans really exploded that mythology with, you know, rates in dry areas like he was coming from, or Darren Doherty, who you mentioned is one of the world's, you know, is the leading permaculture, Keyline, consultant on the planet, is at his farm in Victoria, which gets, I think, around 12 inches of rain. They're growing 3 or 4 inches of topsoil a year. And wetter places like Vermont, where Abe Collins is out there doing some Keyline work, as well as others, he has on record growing 8 inches of topsoil in a season, or, you know, in a year.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's good. That sounds good. All right, so I want to hear where I screwed up. Where did I screw up in that podcast? What did I say that was less than accurate?
You know, it wasn't as much about what was less than accurate as things that just were left out. Yeah. From things that I noticed, there may be one or two things that we could cover that were slightly less than accurate. But I'd like to start with what was the purpose and the origin of the Keyline design system. Yeomans was a miner, and he owned an earth-moving company. And I think Skeeter mentioned that he actually invented the Moto Grader, and he was developing large tracts of land, so he had a deep understanding of contour and movement of water and landscape. But he retired basically onto these couple of ranch areas, and I think it was his brother who was actually killed by a wildfire. And so that really motivated him to develop a fireproof landscape, and that was one of the reasons that he developed these large rain-fed water catchments or ponds that could rapidly be spread across the landscape to put out these wildfires before they spread to somewhere where they would endanger people or animals. Also, it's a premier erosion control strategy, and it allows us to flood irrigate hilly country. That was one thing that I found was a misrepresentation of irrigation, was that you guys talked about flood flow, and actually we're doing flood or sheet irrigation on hill country, and then Yeoman's developed for very flat land another technology that was called flood flow. When you get to very flat land, like 1 foot fall for 1,000 feet of a run.
Well, I know that when I saw your presentation, that was like the coolest thing that I saw. I was really impressed with the idea of flood irrigation on a hillside. And not only that, but you could flood it, and then rather than having the water run just down the hill, you would flood and it would run across the hill because of the keyline plow lines. And it would also, the water that you just flood irrigated with would not run towards the valleys but towards the ridges, which it was like, what a cool idea. Now, of course, in permaculture, it's like part of what we try to do is avoid any irrigation of any kind, but still, that was just nothing else. It was cool.
Definitely. And Yeoman's was actually utilitarian. One of the things he was quoted as saying was that if you have water left in your pond at the end of a drought, you failed. You should use that water to get that pasture growing if you have it. He was storing it to be able to use it. And it's part of the rapid topsoil development system. And we're not putting any energy into irrigating once we build these systems. You just turn a valve and walk down the line where the water's being spread, and you put a flag in, and it spills out into the pasture. So it's a very low energy as far as fossil fuels or other fuels are concerned type of system once it's established. It's basically solid state in the soil and earth landscape. Once you build it, it stays very effectively for a long time, as long as you proper good management.
Good.
Practice good management.
Right. What else? What else?
Well, I mean, you brought up the irrigation thing and how, you know, does she flow onto the hillside or, in the case of flood flow, flatter land, basically gets into the soil much more quickly and rapidly because of the pattern cultivation that is integrated with the irrigation system. And that's all absolutely correct. That reduces also evaporation. It means that water is not sitting up on top of the soil surface, you know, in the hot sun and the wind evaporating, and you're losing it. It just immediately is sinking in because of that keyline ripping or the pattern cultivation. What was what's slightly misleading in some of the previous context, although the concept is completely correct, the idea that the pattern cultivation takes the water and sends it down slope, albeit, but from the valley out to the ridges. In reality, that water is not really traveling from the valley, you know, all the way out to the end of the ridge. What will happen is that because of that pattern cultivation, water that falls on the river ridges and normally would drop down to these valleys just never makes it. It stays right where it lands and just goes into the ground. Now, you know, maybe over short distances you're traveling out towards the ridge, but it's not like you're taking a lot of water in these grooves that the keyline plow makes and just sending it all out to the ridges. So that, you know, but to visualize the pattern and the slope in that, sometimes that's a helpful way to put it, and it often does get taught that way, but on the ground it's technically incorrect.
Okay, all right. I want to just add a quick note that when Owen speaks, he does it with a lot of interpretive dance. So I think, you know, we need to get a rating system going for his dance moves while conveying the message.
Not quite as much as Sep, though. Sep definitely does the premier interpretive dance.
Sep is awesome at interpretive dance. Well, I think it might just seem like more an interpretive dance because he speaks in German. You have no idea what the hell he's saying. You're trying to make the best out of what's going on because it's like, I don't want to wait for the interpreter. I know it's good. And then you got like four or five people in the audience who speak German, and then they go, ah, and you're like, what? What's so funny?
Well, by the way, if there's anybody listening from Argentina, please, been trying to figure out for a while how I can do some classes and do some work down there because I want to learn how to tango. So let's go.
Oh, so then your interpretive dance will be sexy.
Correct.
All right, you had something to add that was on topic?
Yeah, definitely. So there is one case where we are taking the water from the valleys to the ridges, and that's when you're using the irrigation from the dam. And it's not flowing in the rip lines from the plowing or the pattern cultivation. It's actually flowing in a compacted spreader drain. And that allows us to get that water that is in the valley actually out to the ridges and do that flood irrigation on the hill country.
Okay. All right. Now, I know that when watching it in action, when actually seeing it, I think a lot about the idea of how soil that's really, really compacted is maintaining probably about 95% of its soil structure while at the same time being no longer compacted, or at least much less compacted, because it kind of like bumps it just enough that you get these big bricks of soil. And each brick will contain 100% of the soil structure within the brick, and then there's just, you know, this fracture in between, like these massive, I guess dirt clods would be the best word, but...
Or dirt clouds at that point, just because if you walk on this stuff afterwards, especially in like a clay loam or something like this, it's literally like walking on a cloud in a sense compared to what was there before. It's quite a feeling.
Spongy. It's almost like one of those blow-up balloon castles that you get in and jump on with all the little kids. You bring them to your house and have a party.
And then
you
try
and have a party in
you
the
try
field.
And get the kids. You try to knock over the kids. That's what I do. If you bounce real hard, they can't get up. Is that part of your report? The bouncy... Bouncy thing?
The bouncy castle? Yeah, that was a little bit,
okay.
But we can
right.
move on from that. There were a few other things that Yeoman was really trying to do. Drought protection, that's why he had the large on-farm storages and just getting more water into the soil. Also, there's the parallel pattern that's created with the key line plowing, pattern cultivation, and the overall design system, which works very effectively if you're using machinery, and it's more effective at filling space than something that's just on contour, because contours aren't all parallel. But when you create a parallel pattern, you can fill the space more effectively if you're doing tree planting or integrated alley cropping or other sorts of cropping systems. So you don't have kind of a blank part of land that you have to devote to something else.
I suppose one thing that Keyline provides when it comes to ponds that permaculture doesn't go into, although Keyline is included under the permaculture umbrella. But one thing that's usually, because Keyline is going to talk about the key point, and at the key point is an awesome place for the pond, specifically the surface of the pond.
Correct.
And we don't, and for the rest of permaculture stuff, it doesn't go into that very often or very much, kind of leaving that up to the Keyline stuff to kind of go into that. So it's basically, in permaculture, it's more like, all right, find the highest spot that you can possibly build a pond, and then start planning out your following ponds based on what you can do. Although the pattern ends up being, you know, really identical to what the pond zigzag across the property that's outlined in the Keyline stuff.
Correct, yeah. And Yeoman's would build ponds in both series and parallel. So all these ponds were linked together so that he could drain from one pond to the next sequentially so that he could irrigate the area of the farm that needed the water. And then he would have sequences of ponds down the hill that weren't connected by drains but could be flooded from above if needed, so that he had basically planned redundancy in his irrigation system. He also built much larger ponds than a lot of other people in the permaculture world.
Oh, okay. How big was it? Did he like his ponds to be?
My understanding from what I've seen is that some of them were in the hundreds of acre feet range.
Oh, hundreds of acres. But how many acres for surface size?
That would depend on the terrain, but let's say it's a 15-foot average depth pond, then 100 acres would be 150. No, that would be 1,000 acre feet. So 10 acres, 20 acres, you know, in that range.
Right.
So pretty large surface.
That is a lake.
Yeah, definitely.
On his major property, Yobarney, he had 19 ponds, I believe. That was a 760-acre place. He had 500 achy bones because he was out there working so much.
See, I always like the name Yobarney. I always thought that was good.
It is a good name. I'm sorry, but so on 760 acres of land, he had 580 acre feet of water in those 19 storages, which is pretty close to enough to water for like 1,200 households or something like that. So plenty.
How much rainfall did he have there?
At least like 30 inches there, wasn't it?
Wow.
South side of Sydney in New South Wales. So.
Sure, it's 30 inches, not 30 centimeters.
I think it's closer to 30 inches than centimeters.
Really?
There.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
My understanding was that it was 18 inches, but I don't...
Which would be about 30 centimeters.
So we would need to double-check that figure.
Okay,
yep. One of the two.
Because it looks dry. It looks like 18 inches. It doesn't look like 30 inches. But, of course, if it's 30 inches that falls only in the winter, it would look about the same.
Yeah, definitely, if it's a wide distribution and a rainfall pattern.
Yeah.
Well, inches, centimeters, you know. No, yeah. That's a big difference. So I think you're probably right that it is closer to centimeters. So.
Yeah.
And 18 inches.
All right. What's next, guys?
One thing
you guys have a big list. I'm just thinking, you know.
So far,
I feel like I did pretty good. I'm not hearing things.
We've covered most of the list, too, even. You know, there's a few things. One of the goals that Darren focuses on is to wean the farm off the fossil fuel drip, you know, to get machinery out of the picture and be able to do it just with those solid-state irrigation systems and one or two people.
Which is a lot of what we do in permaculture in general.
Definitely. But this allows you to do it on a large scale rather than just a small garden scale or even a medium scale.
Right. Well, I think permaculture, you know, is scalable. And, yeah. I mean, we got a lot of people doing urban permaculture, but a lot of my focus is permaculture that's on like the 10 to 1,000 acre kind of stuff. Although, you know, we just made a podcast earlier saying 500 acres is about as big as SEP would probably be comfortable with. And, frankly, I'm a SEP. I'm a Holzer permaculture guy. So.
Yeah, but then again, he breaks out the world map and says, here's what it's going to look like when I'm done. So
That's true. He breaks out the world map and says, okay, this is plan A.
All continents. Something that Yeoman's developed that you guys didn't talk about is called the key line scale of permanence. And through that, he identifies how permanent features in the landscape are and kind of prioritizes where we would implement our design. And the scale of permanence starts with climate. It's the most permanent. We have the least effect on it or ability to change it effectively. And then it goes to landscape and then water. And he selected water as the highest location on the scale of permanence that we could effectively change rapidly on a farm site. And so that's partly why he decided to have these large farm storages of water. And then on the lowest on the scale is soil. And that's where he put his other main implement, which was the pattern cultivation. So he was kind of attacking this problem from both ends. Soil changes the most rapidly. So we can rapidly develop topsoil, and for the long term, we can store large amounts of water in the landscape. Between that fall roads, trees, structures, and fences, or what he called subdivision. And so it gives us a sequence through which we can plan for permanence in the landscape.
Yeah, I saw his design that was kind of like a, here I'm going to take this open land here and I'm going to make it into a subdivision. But rather than like the subdivisions where everybody gets to have half an acre, it was more like everybody gets to have 6 acres. So he felt that was a better design. And then he had a lot of trees in that system because that's always, in fact, I'm sure I mentioned it in my podcast. That's like one of my complaints about key line is that most of the examples that are given, it's like, you know, low on trees, not a lot in the way of trees. Is that, is my whining accurate, or am I a dumbass?
Well,
or something in between. Something in between.
Something
in between is an option here.
We'll stick with that. But no, that's right. Like, usually the tree belts that you almost did end up planting and that you know, survive to this day, if you look at the satellite views, are narrow. They're just maybe, you know, one or two rows of trees. And usually only a couple of species involved, and that's something that permaculture and Darren Doherty and people doing this work have added to it, is wider tree belts, you know, more multi-species kind of forestry, and, you know, even shrubs on the outside that are feeding livestock, since it is integrated with a cattle or livestock system at the same time. So, yeah, that's accurate, but at the same time, Yeomans did talk a lot about trees in the books that he wrote, and they played a key importance, you know, both not only for bringing up other minerals from the soil that the grass isn't accessing, but also for their, you know, value as timber, and in the city forest in particular, which was his last book, and I think the most innovative, which I think you mentioned on a podcast, can be found at soilandhealth.org for free or for a donation, which did you take?
Did you hear that boom? I wonder if that was the bone sauce exploding. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I heard a boom.
But no, that's in City Forest in particular, he talks about trees being on the low slope side of suburban sort of neighborhoods and communities. So essentially all the sewage waste and these kinds of things would actually be feeding these forests. And these forests would be then feeding, you know, become resources for the community and be managed by the community that was there. And all the streets and everything are laid out on key lines, and it makes an immense amount of sense. And he went into actually other kind of more philosophical stuff in that book that goes probably beyond our discussion here that is quite innovative, and not just innovative, but ahead of its time.
All right. So now I'm really getting the impression, guys, that I made a podcast on Key Line, and I'm not really a Key Line guy, but I did a damn good job anyway.
Definitely.
So now I'm getting the sense, I hear noises outside, like there might be wrapping up here. How much more we got?
A couple things. I think the definition of Key Line is important. It's really tough to describe on a podcast. It really needs some graphics. So if you're interested in that, you can go to the yeomansplow.com site, and there's a free article you can read that has the topographical and geographical basis of Key Line. Gives you a little bit better idea of what the Key Line is and how it plays a role in the Key Line process.
Well, it's kind of like where the convex meets the concave in the valley, right? That's the key point.
Correct. Yeah, the Key Line is a contour line. It's a contour line that only exists in the valley shape, so you need to know some of the geographical anatomy. And it's where the water changes from picking up speed and eroding more to slowing down and depositing more. So you often see it being a green spot in a valley because the water starts soaking in and settling out organic nutrients and things like that.
Yeah, an actual kind of like dot.
Yeah, yeah. They literally, once you start to look for them, pop out of the landscape at you.
Sometimes even a spring will pop out at that location on occasion in landscapes. But also the reason, one of the reasons it's so elegant to build a dam there is, I think you may have mentioned the podcast before, it's you move the least amount of dirt for the most amount of dam space or water storage. But not only that, is because it's, as Neil mentioned, it's the depositional zone there, that's often a healthy source of clays in the landscape as well. So it's a great material to be making a dam with.
Yeah. All right.
One final thing that you guys talked about was the livestock causing compaction. And I just wanted to make a note that it's not actually the livestock that cause compaction, like on a wet field. It's actually the length of disturbance if they're left there too long. And compaction is often a function of overgrazing, which means that a plant has been bitten too many times in a row without time to recover, and the roots die, and that's what leads to compaction. It's not the livestock that lead to it. It's poor management.
So now you're also so Owen is also in the holistic management stuff. That would be Alan Savory's stuff. And I thought Alan Savory said that there's no such thing as overgrazing.
I don't believe that he said that. What he might have said, what you might be referring to, is you can't overgraze a pasture. He did make that sort of controversial statement. But what he means by that is you overgraze plants. Overgraze plants, because what happens, and then when you leave the animals in too long, is especially during the growing season, say, an animal will come and bite the plant. Then it continues to grow, and you haven't taken the animals out of there. Well, it's using that root energy to grow that plant. It's not growing a pasture, it's growing a plant with those specific roots. And you come and bite it again, you take away that root reserve that it needs to continue its growth, and then it can become overgrazed. Severely grazing it just one time is not the same as overgrazing it after it uses its root reserve to regrow. At the same time, while it's eating those chocolates, because you turn the animals in, and the first plants they eat are essentially the chocolates in the pasture, all those other plants that aren't getting eaten are being over-rested.
I always call it ice cream.
Ice cream. Ice cream.
Chocolate. Chocolate ice cream. Yeah.
Well, see, and it's a bad example for me because I don't eat any sugar at all, so I would have to choose, you know, some delicious fat or something.
So but you live your life without pie?
For the most part, yeah, rarely.
I got priorities.
Yeah. I did have some berry pie the other night. It was very delicious and not actually very sweet, but
wouldn't that have sugar in it?
It did have a little. It did have
they
a little.
Didn't eat any.
Okay, I guess they never.
Yeah.
The point is
busted. That's right. This podcast uncovers the truth. People who don't eat any sugar at all. They do.
So the point being, like, at that whole buffet that's open to them, they're going to eat the stuff they like the best at first.
Yeah.
And then when that regrows again, they're going to eat it again, and they're going to leave the stuff they don't like so much alone entirely. And that will be over-rested. That plant needs to be grazed, too, ultimately, which is why you need to get into the higher densities and the shorter duration and all the other stuff that goes with it. But that's kind of what that Neil's referring to with the compaction issues.
So with the compaction, you're saying that if we've got wet ground, wet soil out there, then and we run cattle out there on the wet soil, then it does not compact it unless all of the plants out there die from it. Am I getting warm?
Closer, but not all the plants. The compaction is due to overgrazing of individual plants. It's not due to the cattle just being there. It's due to people leaving them there for too long and spread out too thinly.
All right.
Absolutely. So if you get them in there and it's muddy, but you get them out of there quick and you graze it tall and you keep them moving and move them to the next muddy spot, that very spot might be your best response next spring or, you know, whenever the growth starts again.
Okay. All right. Gentlemen, any last things?
Thanks, Paul.
All right, that was easy. I thought I was going to end up bloody, like, man, you lying sack of shit kind of thing.
That's once you turn this off.
All right, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about keyline, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.